It's hard to know where the tipping point is for the Great Salt Lake. Bonnie Baxter, a biologist and the director of the Great Salt Lake Institute, told us last year, about this time actually, that we could reach that tipping point where the ecosystem of the lake begins to collapse by November. If the lake got to a certain level, she said, and the salinity levels got so concentrated, it could happen. And then November came and went, and the lake level continued to drop. The salinity numbers kept climbing, and now everyone seems to be bracing themselves. But how long does a collapse actually take, and what does it look like? Bonnie Baxter joined us again this week.
I'm out there on average about once a week, and it's an entirely different landscape. The water is evaporating and disappearing at a rate that is visible over days. Because the lake is so shallow, a foot of elevation decrease is something that's visible in miles. Where I used to just get out of my car and grab a shore sample, now you literally need to walk a mile to the waterline, 2 miles in some cases. In White Rock Bay, the white rock that used to poke out of the water is now something you walk to. Egg Island and Bridger Bay around Antelope Island is also something you walk to. The smell that wafts into the city when we get those winds that come just right over the lake actually is biology, and it's a sign of a really vibrant saline ecosystem. And now when I go to some of the beaches on Antelope Island that I sample often, I don't smell that. These microbialites that I study have been beached. They're no longer in the water. They are like tombstones out there. There are no brine flies flying around my feet. The gulls that usually are running around the shore eating the brine flies are floating out in the deep water, hoping one of the pupa will release a brine fly so they can eat one. It's otherworldly. It's silent. It's just different. It brings me to tears. For a moment, I'm measuring salinity, which has gone crazy high, and I'm analyzing water samples, and I'm trying to scrape some mats off one of these microbialites, and I'm busy doing my science, and then another moment, I just stop and cry. We're seeing this system crash before our eyes. I don't know any other way to say it.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're looking back now a year or so from the news last summer that the Great Salt Lake had reached its lowest level ever, or for as long as they've been measuring it. Scientists are trying to determine how long before the lake becomes too salty or too dry to sustain life. So that's where we're going to start today, lake levels and salinity. We spoke this week with Christine Rumsey and Ryan Rowland of the U.S. Geological Survey. Ryan covers the levels part, Christine the salinity part. As we come to the end of another unseasonably hot, record-breaking summer, we asked, how did the lake come through another year? Ryan got us started.
The short answer is this water year, the lake is so far behaving very similar to how it behaved last year. In other words, in response to spring runoff earlier this year, the lake only rose about a foot, and that's what happened last water year as well.
Yep.
Typically, it's more than that, a couple of feet. And now the lake is declining at about the same rate that it declined last year. And, yeah, we'll be setting obviously every day basically now as the lake drops, we're setting new record lows, and we expect that to continue.
So let's break it down, lake levels and then salinity. So let's start with lake levels, at least specifics. Remind us where the Ryan, remind us where this water is coming from first and what you're looking at. Like, where is this water coming from? What are you paying attention to?
Well, we have stream gauges on the major surface water inflows to the lake. So we have a gauge, Bear River near Corinne, Utah, Weber River near Plain City. We have a gauge on the Goggin Drain, which drains Salt Lake Valley. And then we have a gauge on Farmington Bay outflow. So that measures the amount of water moving from Farmington Bay into the main body of the South Arm. Those are our four surface water inflow gauges. And the Bear River is historically the largest source of water to the lake. So last summer was a very, very poor water year. Cumulative flows around the state were close to the lowest measured. They were. I think we ended up in terms of area-based cumulative runoff for the state at the third lowest at the end of last water year. And so really all eyes were on the snowpack this winter and through the beginning part of this year, because we knew the flows were very poor. And the snowpack looked and this, by the way, is thanks to our friends at the NRCS, the Natural Resource Conservation Service. They measure snowpack around the state. The snowpack looked good up until January. And then, I don't know if you recall, the storms just stopped.
Yeah.
And we got essentially no snow from January through mid to late February.
Yeah, everyone was loving it until then, right? Yeah. Like, this is great. And then, irk.
Yeah. And so what started off as a pretty optimistic-looking snowpack turned into one that ended up below normal, statewide. And that kind of sealed the fate for how much inflow to the lake we'd get in response to spring runoff. And the lake did rise about a foot due to spring runoff earlier this year. And that's basically how much it rose last year, which was the very poor water year. So we did not improve very much. And I look at that January through mid to late February period where we didn't get any storms is what sealed our fate. So the inflows in response to spring runoff were not poor. Flows in the upper regions, upper basins around the state were improved relative to the previous water year. And a lot of that is actually due to we had better soil moisture conditions leading into the runoff season this year, which led to a more efficient runoff. But again, it just was not enough to bring the lake up more than it came up last year, essentially. So since April, which is when the lake peaked this year.
April.
Yeah, it peaked in April, which is a little bit early. In good water years, it'll be maybe in June. So, but since April, it's been on a steady decline. And like I said earlier, that decline looks a lot like last year in terms of the rate that it's declining.
So I think a lot of people felt hopeful about that early snow. Then it disappointed. But then we got this monsoonal rain that seemed – and people got their hopes up for that too. So did that make much of a difference at all?
Yeah. Direct precipitation to Great Salt Lake, just rain falling on the lake, is actually a very significant source of water for the lake.
Really?
I think some estimates put – direct precipitation as much as 30% of the input to Great Salt Lake. So the monsoon certainly had a benefit. We haven't quantified it, but it's probably reasonable to think that might have slowed down how quickly the lake was decreasing, although we haven't done an analysis on that.
Where's the lake now, level-wise?
The lake right now is at 4189.2 feet, and that's about a foot lower than last October when it leveled out and we established.
It's a foot lower?
Yeah, we're a foot below the record we set last October.
What do you make of that? That seems terrifying.
Well, I mean, the bottom line is the lake only came up a foot this year.
Yeah.
And so far it's declined 2 feet. So we've lost, we have a net loss of a foot.
Okay, so let's talk about salinity, what this all means. Put that in perspective for us and those numbers in perspective. Like, give us an example.
Okay. So let's say you had a liter Nalgene bottle and some table salt. So, and you fill your Nalgene to 1 liter of water, and then you weigh out 1 gram of table salt, sodium chloride, and then you combine, you add that salt into your Nalgene, shake it up, you now have a solution with dissolved salt in it, and the concentration of that solution would be 1 gram per liter. So you've added 1 gram of salt to 1 liter of water. And so when we talk about concentrations and a gram per liter, that's kind of what we're referring to, is mm-hmm. what's the mass of salt in the water.
So I take my Nalgene mm-hmm. bottle out and I'm able to somehow get onto the lake right now and I dip it in there. How much salt is in there?
Then you would have 176 grams per liter in that Nalgene bottle. That's what you'd have. That's where we're at this moment. And to put that number into perspective in terms of ocean water, you know, we've been to the ocean. People know you can taste that salt. Well, Great Salt Lake water, depending on where you are, is 3 to 5 times as salty as the ocean. And in some areas, it's 6 to 8 times saltier than the ocean. So it's a very hypersaline, extreme environment in terms of salinity.
In a normal year, I'll just say it this way, salty is the lake. How salty is it supposed to be to sustain that ecosystem, the life out there?
Sure. Kind of the threshold, the range that the Salinity Advisory Committee has identified. This is a group of Great Salt Lake kind of stakeholders, scientists, managers who've established a salinity matrix where they identify healthy ranges for different organisms in the south arm of Great Salt Lake. And so I'll put it in context of what a healthy salinity range is for brine shrimp, an important invertebrate out in the lake. And the threshold that they like and that they thrive in is 120 to 160 grams per liter.
Okay.
And where we're at now, again, is 176 grams per liter. It causes stress on the organism. It affects their ability to reproduce. It affects the way they reproduce. And it affects their ability to thrive. And it might affect phytoplankton, which is their food. And so we are, as well as many others, are concerned about this and how it's going to affect the food web, how it's going to affect the brine shrimp industry, and at what point it's irreversible.
I'm not sure if you've measure this or you if you can answer this, but if you pick a target where the lake needs to be safely, can you reverse engineer that or target where the salinity needs to be, right? I mean, but it's the level first, but can you reverse engineer that, you know, follow the flow back to the tributaries, the farms and the ranches and the, you know, counties and water conservation districts, and can you come up with a number and say to them, this is what we need to be getting into the lake?
There's a lot of work happening at the state level to figure out where the sweet spot is as going forward. We're not we don't make policy. We don't right. Do any kind of management on the lake. But that's a big effort right now to understand where the lake can reasonably where the lake can be managed to satisfy the multiple
so that can
interests.
Be done.
I mean, I'm an optimist. I think we can solve together just about any problem. And so, we'll just have to see how this plays out.
Sure.
There's a lot of tough decisions that are going to have to be made, and we'll just have to see how it plays out. We'll continue playing our role, which is making sure everybody has
the numbers.
Have numbers yeah. to work with.
So what is it like to go out there and collect this data? I mean, what are you seeing just when you go out that startles you or alarms you or reassures you about, like, how is that terrain? How is the shoreline different? How much more difficult is it to collect this data now that it's shrinking that body of water?
Mm-hmm. Well, currently the lake is inaccessible for our data collection efforts. Mm-hmm. So the lake level is so low that boats are not able to launch. Mm-hmm. And so that really hinders our ability to understand the lake and various changes happening. So the last time I was out on the lake was in late July. And I was sampling out at a site we have on the railroad causeway, where there's an opening between the north and south arm and water exchange between the two bodies of water. And when I first started on Great Salt Lake 8 years ago, I went out with Ryan, my first time ever on Great Salt Lake, and you could see the water level all the way to Lakeside. It's a far west side along that causeway. And so we could see water exchange there, very little shoreline exposed. And it was an amazing experience to be out there for the first time. You saw the bright red north arm, the bright green south arm. And now you go out there and there's just vast swaths of exposed lake bed. I mean, that western area where Lakeside is completely dry. And then even just driving out east, probably a couple miles at least, there's just exposed lake bed as far as you can see. And what's been interesting is to see the evolution of the microbialites as they're exposed and then erode away. And so you kind of can see this transition of a newly exposed microbialite. You can kind of see the structure existing, and then you go out a couple weeks later or a month later, and you can just see them eroding away. And that has been pretty striking. And for a lot of our team that go out there and sample along the causeway, is just seeing that change and just, where's the lake? You go out there and it's just, where's the lake? And you're driving, and it's a while before you see it, and that's a pretty drastic change that we're all experiencing.
When you look at the conditions, do you feel a sense of optimism, or I don't know if it's dread, or just, I mean, what's the emotion that you feel right now?
So I feel pretty strongly about what I'm going to say right here. I have great faith in our ability as human beings to reason through a problem and figure out a way to solve the problem. And this is no different. We have a set of challenges before us, and we have the information in terms of the data that's being gathered to understand what needs to be done to solve the problem. The way to, you know, the decisions that have to be made in order to solve the problem might be tough, but we can work through this. And I think it's really important for people to stay optimistic and remember that we all play a role in this. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, I just speaking for myself, I have a role as an individual to play in this. I think about how I'm using water at my home. And it's going to take an effort. Policymakers and all of us as individuals, just citizens of Utah, we all have a role to play in this, and we need to stay optimistic because we can succeed. And I feel very strongly about that.
I think I feel both optimism and dread. Mm. You know, we keep a pulse on the lake. We can see it changing. We can see it with our eyes. We can see it with the data. And the problem is real. It's a very real challenge in front of us, and it's a very hard problem to solve. But I'm optimistic. My optimism comes from the fact that people are engaged. There's a really engaged Great Salt Lake community of managers, scientists, and people, just citizens, you know, not just of citizens, involved in the lake. And, you know, there's tools being developed. There's legislation being passed that is a start that we need to build on. There's also, I think, greater awareness. So the U.S. Geological Survey, in cooperation with the state, has developed a hydromapper. This is a website that provides data to the public, to everyone, trying to make that information available and digestible. And I think our hope is that, you know, we're out there, we connect with the lake because we've been studying it for so long, that we can share that with the public, that they can start to track it and start to connect with it and start to build an appreciation. And then it all comes back to kind of what we can do about it. And if we care about it, you know, I'm optimistic that we as a collective citizenry of Utah can make the change. We can decide this matters to us. This is a value, and we can change the way we use water. Again, it's a big task, but we can do it. You know, we could do it if we set our mind to it.
Well, thank you both.
Yeah.
It's Christine Rumsey. She's a hydrologist with the United States Geological Survey, along with Ryan Rowland. He's a supervisory hydrologist with the USGS. Christine and Ryan are both part of the Utah Water Science Center staff. We'll take a break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Thanks to KUER's mobile app, you can keep NPR Utah as your essential connection wherever you go. Our free mobile app keeps you informed with the latest local stories from KUER News. Explore on-demand podcasts like Radio West, State Street, and Sent Away. Or enjoy nonstop streams of our daily programming, BBC World Service, and classical KUER. Stay connected to your member station with the KUER mobile app, available for free wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're doing an update of the lake, the Great Salt Lake, of course. For months now, years really, scientists have been predicting a series of cascading effects as the lake level drops and the saline concentration rises. And it seems to be happening. Shorebird and brine shrimp numbers are seriously declining. The life cycles of brine flies and all the other micro creatures that sustain that ecosystem are in flux. We spoke with Bonnie Baxter again this week. She's a biologist and director of the Great Salt Lake Institute.
I think I came to talk to you just after we hit a historic low. And we are almost a foot below that right now. So this last year has been pretty devastating. We surpassed that low that we hit last summer. We surpassed that on July 3rd, and every day has been a new historic low since then. And I think we probably won't see the lowest of the low for 2022 until November.
We'll come back to this in a moment, but people are starting to pay attention. You're seeing national coverage of the condition of the lake. What are you seeing? What's happened? What's transpired in the last year? Attention by lawmakers and policymakers, and like, how do you assess that part of the story?
Yeah, so I guess this is the thing that gives me a little bit of optimism, because there is agreement across so many sectors of humans, through legislators, through people that work at nonprofits, through academics, through industry. Everybody agrees we need to get water to the lake. And that makes me hopeful. We're not fighting some evil entity who thinks that this is the right thing to be happening. Everyone recognizes the problem. And I think the legislative session last spring was amazing. The fact that that many pieces of water conservation legislation passed in Utah unanimously in that one session is phenomenal. And I think some of the strategies are putting really great solutions in the hands of people to be part of the solution, not finger pointing like you're the bad guy and you're going to be penalized, but instead, hey, here's an opportunity for you to give your water right to the lake and you won't lose it. And hey, how about we measure that water that you're using for irrigation? We can pay for putting in these meters and we can measure that. And then you actually know how much water you're using, you know how much you can afford to give up towards this sovereign land that is Great Salt Lake. So I think I loved the positive nature of those pieces of legislation that allow folks to feel like they're contributing. And I think the HB 410 that creates a trust to, analyze solutions for the lake, I think that has so much potential. Mm-hmm. And the trustees of that are National Audubon and Nature Conservancy. And I think as they develop this process, it's going to be just so great to have that pot of infrastructure money that we can then continue to apply towards Great Salt Lake Project. So many positive things came out of the legislative session that didn't stop the drought, that didn't stop the warming of climate change, that didn't stop the lake going down. But it has the potential to impact things in a positive way. There's also a federal saline lakes bill Mitt Romney was here recently, and Senator Romney was getting to know the lake a little better. And I think that bill funds some USGS monitoring of the lake, which is great, but also has a pot of money for investigating engineering solutions, which is not something we've done yet. And it's hard to come up with money for that. So I think that could be really interesting. So I appreciate that federal money, and I appreciate the federal infrastructure money, and that we're not just having to use Utah tax dollars to pay for this, because if this lake dries up, it will be a crisis that affects more than just the state of Utah.
I want to talk about a meeting that happened last month. Scientists, agency leaders, various stakeholders. This is called the Technical Advisory Group. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the meeting, if you would. I mean, we'll get to the findings here in a moment, but maybe start with the tone of that meeting and the sentiment of the people there to report what they were seeing.
Sure. These are quarterly state meetings that we have, and I'm part of an external technical advisory group that helps advise the division of wildlife. That's an open meeting. So there are, you know, many people come to that meeting just to observe what's going on. So I guess I'm saying there's nothing secret about it, but mostly it is a state of the lake quarterly meeting. Mm. And we hear from folks who are studying brine shrimp, folks who are modeling the ecology of the system and plugging in new units of measurements to see what the model does. And we are hearing from people who study the birds and what their observations are. And so it's really kind of a cool meeting to get an update from several different angles. And the overlap that we were all sharing, that we were all seeing, as I talked about the microbialites not having any mats this year and the brine fly pupa not being there and the dead brine fly pupa on the shorelines and no adult flies. And I'm going through this whole thing about what I've seen. And then other folks are talking about how they're not seeing certain bird species where they should be. And they don't know if they've moved or if they're just lower in numbers, or they're seeing emaciated birds. And then the other folks were talking about the brine shrimp seem to be doing okay at this higher salinity. But they could be having shifts in reproduction. Like they could be changing some of the ways that they're making cyst or live birth, for instance. But they tend to be more flexible. I think the brine flies are really concerning because there's more of their little caterpillars in the water and they're not making cocoons on the bottom of the lake. So I'm worried that we're disrupting their life cycle, and they feed several sectors of birds. So in this meeting, we talked about that quite a bit. We talked about what was going on with the invertebrates, what was going on with the birds that eat them, what was going on with the microbialites. And it was a really sad meeting. I know at least one person left to go cry. And we talked about how maybe at the next meeting we needed to bring antidepressants and pass them around. And like I've been a part of this group for a long time, probably 15 years, and I don't think I've ever experienced that sadness, that joint sadness that was felt in that room by a group of scientists working in all different realms of the science. So it was sad. And I think that I don't know what's next.
Let's talk more about the brine shrimp, because I wanted to go through some of these different things that you talked about. You say that sounds like the shrimp are doing something weird with their reproductive cycles. Are they altering it based on the conditions? What's going on? Can you tell?
So brine shrimp have been studied really well in this system because they are a commercial product. So there's been a lot of biology done on brine shrimp, and we understand their normal life cycle is to have live birth in the summer and then to produce cyst. When it gets cold, they shift their reproductive cycle and they produce cyst into the lake. And these encysted embryos, they're kind of like eggs. They just float on the surface of the water. And that's what's harvested. That's what the brine shrimp industry is. And if anybody ever bought sea monkeys, that's the little powder that you get in the mail, those little cysts. So they store well, they keep well. This is the industry sends those cysts all around the world for aquaculture. So if you eat fish, you've likely eaten something that munched on brine shrimp from Great Salt Lake. So it's important to the state to keep that product healthy. And of course, it's important to the brine shrimp companies, and it's important to the birds that those shrimp stay healthy. So that's monitored in a really sustainable way by the state in conjunction with industry. And it's really kind of a beautiful partnership. So I think as we talk about what we're seeing with the shrimp, it's a little unclear because there have to be some measurements done on how many live births are they having versus how many cysts are they making. And that science is going to take us a little time to figure out. And are the cysts quality cysts? Are they hatchable cysts, or are they just going to die because they weren't fully formed or something? We don't know any of that, right? So it's too early to know if the shrimp are impacted at this elevated salinity. And the brine shrimp have a little more flexibility in their salinity tolerance than brine flies do. I think it's the brine flies that are really scaring me the most, because we're seeing more of the larva in the water column along the lakeshore, just billions of glossy little pupa that were washed off microbialites dead. And I've never seen that before. Usually you see the empty cases after the flies have hatched. Instead, these are fully formed little cocoons that have just washed off the bottom of the lake.
Because they didn't hatch.
And then, so there's an accumulation of the little caterpillars in the water, the larvae swimming around. Is that because they can't pupate? Because there's no mats, because the mats can't live at that salinity. So they have nothing to eat on the bottom of the lake, nothing to adhere to properly. And so it's disrupting their life cycle. And the concern is that if you disrupt the life cycle, you end up with adults that can't make babies. So that halts all of the flies. And so the signals we're seeing from the flies are far more dramatic than anything we're seeing with the shrimp. And I think their salinity tolerance, you know, the literature says their salinity tolerance is not as flexible as brine shrimp. So it's really the flies I'm worried about. And if you think about it, the flies feed more birds than the shrimp, because they feed diving ducks that dive down and munch off the bottom of the lake, and they feed birds that eat out of the water column, and then they feed with the adults either on the surface of the water or on the shore. So that's a lot of different lifestyles of birds that eat the flies. And I think that shrimp just feed ducks that eat out of, or I keep saying ducks. Shrimp just feed the birds that eat out of the water column. And so that's more of a single compartment of birds, right? So I think we will feel the loss of brine flies really quickly in terms of the numbers of birds and the species that are impacted.
The birds out there, what are you seeing that's changing? Is there a possibility that bird populations have figured out this is not the source we thought it was, and they're starting to change their behaviors, change their migrations, or whatever that might be? Are we seeing any of that yet, as far as you can tell?
the observations on the ground are a little frightening, but we don't know what it means yet. So in places where you used to see lots of birds, say the Antelope Island Causeway is notorious. People come from all over the world to see Wilson's phalarope in the summer out off the causeway there to see avocets and stilts. And it's like Mad Max on the causeway right now. There's like no birds. And then finally you start to get close to Antelope Island and there's a little puddle of groundwater and there's a billion birds like in that one little mud puddle because there's nowhere else to be. And then as I mentioned, along the shore of the lake where I'm used to seeing so many flies and so many birds eating the flies, there's no birds. It's just silent. So it's hard to even drive on the causeway to Antelope Island right now because it doesn't even look like you're at Great Salt Lake.
Bonnie Baxter, she's a professor of biology at Westminster College, also the director of the Great Salt Lake Institute. We'll take another break, come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Weekends on KUER are filled with the same high-quality news and engaging conversations you hear every weekday. Keep up on the latest news with Weekend Edition and All Things Considered. Indulge your curiosity with Radiolab and Hidden Brain. Or dive into the rich storytelling of Snap Judgment and This American Life. The best in NPR news and entertainment awaits you this weekend on KUER. See what's in store at KUER.org/schedule.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Whether you pray for rain or not, we all long for it around here, especially if you're keeping an eye on the Great Salt Lake. The promises of a wet winter fizzled out. Monsoonal rain wasn't nothing, but it wasn't enough to change what scientists say is a steady decline for the lake. And just a reminder here, the drought isn't helping, of course, but the lake is shrinking and becoming alarmingly salty because more and more water is being diverted from the rivers that feed it. This week on the program, we've been asking, how did the Great Salt Lake fare another year? Bonnie Baxter is with us. She's director of the Great Salt Lake Institute. We got some rain this year, in monsoonal rain, that people thought was had to matter in some way, but did it?
I think we got direct precipitation into the lake, which is always good that you don't have to depend on it to filter through the watershed and get there. But there was no change. My understanding is there was very little change measured in the inflow gauges into the lake. So in terms of the rain that went into the watershed that made its way to the lake, that made no difference. So just the direct precipitation took it up like an inch or so, but that inch was gone within a week.
Seems like we've tackled at least part of the awareness element of this big story. People now know how drastic it is. Seems there, you know, all kinds of coverage, local coverage, national coverage about the conditions there, the state of the lake. Okay, now there's an awareness, but it seems like we've got to now move to the question. The more difficult questions, it seems, right? That is, what does it mean for the difficult decisions about agriculture, the difficult decisions about growth, the difficult decisions about, you know, behavioral choices? Are we there yet?
I have to ask the state, like, when can we call this an emergency? When can we think about the public trust doctrine and how the state is holding this lake in public trust and that it needs to have a right to water. I don't know the answer to that. Like, when do you sound those alarms that say, okay, we've reached a state where no one can take any water from the lake? Is that even possible? Because that would basically supersede water rights, which is something that is not done.
So we would have to do something
drastic.
Drastic and unprecedented.
Drastic. And, you know, that's what happened with Mono Lake, and it worked.
Yeah.
And so I think that's always on the table. But I just have to ask the question, like, how much worse does it need to be before that's an issue? Is it still that water can go to agriculture and industry? Is it still the case that Salt Lake City has no restriction on water use? Like, aren't we going to do anything, you know, to circumvent this? So the optimism I got from the last legislative session, quickly goes to the question of, isn't there something more? And what is that next step? And at what level do you want this catastrophe to be? When I spoke with you last year, we talked about ecosystem collapse starting at about 17% salinity. So that's 170 grams in a liter of water.
Yeah.
And that's what we would see in the laboratory with these cyanobacteria that feed these invertebrates. And so we thought that would be the crisis point. And as I've mentioned, we're now observing all of these changes, indeed, because we've lived a year higher than 17%. So now we're approaching 18%. In fact, I've been measuring 18% out in the open water.
Tell me why it is that you're measuring something higher than Christine Rumsey, who was with us earlier. They can't get boats out there, but you're paddling out there.
I can get a paddleboard out there. So USGS does such a great service for the lake. They have these gauges that measure inflow and gauges that measure salinity and other environmental parameters. But those are floating gauges. And the one that brings us the most information about the changing situation of the lake is at Saltaire. But they are going to have to move it now because it's also becoming beached. So the way salinity works, it's a bit like your salad dressing in that there's density differences when you have higher concentrations of salt water and lower. They don't mix very well. So you have these little pockets around the lake that are getting too salty and they're not mixing with the other parts of the lake. That's what we're seeing in the bays around Antelope Island because sandbars are kind of cutting off those bays. And so they're getting super saline. And so I wanted to know, like, well, how about when it's out in the open water?
Yeah.
And so you have to hike your paddleboard out there and then put it in the water. First, you got to carry it. So
you're reading 18%. You're reading 180 grams
consistently or higher. Yeah, consistently.
And why hasn't it collapsed at that level?
Well, I think we're seeing the beginnings of that.
Yeah.
I think I can't find thick microbialite mats anymore. That's a true indicator to me. And seeing these changes in the brine fly life cycle tell me that that piece of the food chain is collapsing before our eyes. There are less birds in places where they used to be. Does that mean there's less birds or have they just moved? We're not sure about that yet.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the birds are emaciated. Does that mean they're eating things that aren't as nutritious? Like, for instance, are those brine fly larvae or pupa not as nutritious? Are the brine shrimp cysts not as nutritious as they used to be? We don't know. So right now, we're taking these observations and we're asking lots of questions. And I think we're going to have to just dive into this and start measuring fat content, for instance, in these things that birds are eating to try to understand what's going on. So I don't because this is happening in real time, we don't have all the answers yet. And I think that we need to understand that we are witnessing a collapse of this ecosystem. We absolutely are seeing something that could be a point of no return. And the way to reverse that, get more water to the lake. We get more water to the lake. I guarantee if we did this, if we could get more water to the lake in a calendar year, we could recover. But if it's 2 years, I don't know. And some of the modeling from ecologists is saying that 2 years is too long, that the whole system is gone by that time. So how long can we be at this salinity? That answer is an ongoing experiment, and I don't like doing an experiment with those sorts of consequences.
So what do you think the national coverage has meant for the lake? There's that scene in the Monty Python movie, The Holy Grail, where they're collecting the dead bodies from the plague, and there's that
bring
one
out
man
the
who
dead.
Yeah, bring out your dead, and there's the one man who keeps insisting, I'm not dead yet. And you are hearing some people saying, don't call it a dead lake yet. Like, this doom and gloom is not really helpful. So I'm wondering, how are you thinking about, on one hand, like, how do you balance wanting people to understand the absolute severity of the situation, you know, with the fact that it's – how do you balance that with the fact that it's not dead yet, that being optimistic does bring with it its own kind of engagement and energy that's – like, how are you managing both of those things?
I have to be really careful because I'm a scientist and I report what I see and what my findings are. And when I publish something, it is well-referenced and well-documented and it's been through reviewers and I've done the statistics. And I don't put a feeling around that of optimism or pessimism. Mm. It's simply, this is what we're observing, right?
Yeah.
Without human values added to it. And I understand that the process of science is no more unbiased than any other human endeavor, but we at least play that game in science where we really try and we endeavor to let the data speak for itself and tell our reader or listener in this case what that might mean.
Yeah.
So I'm not a sociologist and I don't study humans, nor do I want to. however, I think that's a really important job right now because this is really good advice. Like, why would anybody want to help save the lake if they thought it was dead?
Yeah.
So I understand people saying that, and I am by nature an optimist, and I live here. I don't want to be breathing dust. I think that everyone has skin in this game, right? So I get that comment. We don't want to be all doom and gloom. We want to say there's a way. And if you were to say to me, you know, what's the way, what's the path that's going to change this and turn it around, it's just more water. It's more water. And the changes that were made because of the legislation last spring, I don't know if that's enough water. Nobody knows yet. Nobody can quantify that because, again, we need the sociologist to talk about people's behavior. Mm. Do they, you know, and we need someone to think about the fact that in any Western city where they've raised the price of water, water usage goes down. That's psychology and sociology, you know. So we should maybe try that. Like, so I don't know. But you asked about the national attention on the lake, and it has been real. In fact, many of us that work on the lake have been talking to reporters all over the world, and I appreciate that attention. I really do. And it does put some pressure on the solution makers, I think, but also putting us under the microscope, the people who are working at the lake and thinking about the lake daily, it's a little bit stressful, but I feel like this is important work, right? So I think everyone has a role to play, and I appreciate journalists playing a role in this, and I've learned so much from talking to them and hearing the way that the stories come out, and I think folks are doing a fantastic job covering the issues that matter to people. I really do. So I want to give a shout out to the journalists there who are working hard, especially the ones in the state of Utah, because this is an important problem, and I just think they're nailing it. I think it's wonderful. And I thank you for your attention to the lake. It's great.
Bonnie Baxter, thanks.
Thank you.
Bonnie Baxter, she's the director of the Great Salt Lake Institute, also a professor of biology at Westminster College. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Andrew Christiansen. The program produced by Carrie Watson, Benjamin Bombard, and Tim Slover. Stephanie Allerton is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.